Hey everyone, it's me, Alan Schimmel for Tech Strong Gang. We've got a great gang today, and we've got some great stuff to cover. We're going to talk about AI and hardware and DevOps and security like we always do. You're watching Tech Strong Gang. Hi everyone. Well, we've got another episode of Tech Strong Gang. Mike Vizard's not here today, but let me tell you who is. Leading off, we have our managing editor for DevOps.com and Security Boulevard, Sharon Florentine. Hey, Sharon, welcome.
Thanks. Great to be back. Thank you.
It's great to have you on. Next up is Mitch Ashley, our CTO and principal research analyst at Tech Strong Research. Mitchell, good. Thanks for coming on. Well, Mitch is on every day.
Good day.
Good to
I'm
see
back.
You, Mitch.
I'm back.
And then making her initial appearance on the gang, but she's been part of the Tech Strong family for a long time. Tracy Reagan, CEO, founder of Deploy Hub and open source aficionado. Okay.
Enthusiast.
Extraordinaire. Tracy, it's great to have you on. Thank you.
I'm so privileged to be here.
All righty. Well, privileged to have you. Exactly. All right. So let's jump in. This is Tuesday, just another Tuesday in paradise in the tech world. We're going to start things off with a recent article. It wasn't on any of the TechStrong sites, but we'll have the note in the notes. You'll have the URL. But it's this discussion of, has AI reached the point where it's its own industry, its own category, its own private Idaho, right? And this reminds me, Mitch, back when we were doing Still Secure and Safe Access NAC, you know, Gartner had started this NAC category, and a lot of people were very upset that it wasn't a product, it was a feature. It was going to be a feature in access management. Mm-hmm. But when we look at technology, isn't that the way of things? Things first become categories and industries unto themselves, and then they get kind of subsumed as the forward march goes on. But is AI special? I don't know. What do you guys think?
I say no.
Okay, we have our first no.
No. Now, if we go back and look at technology and as we have evolved, it's just in the lifetime of my career, some of the big moments, one of the biggest moments was DB2.
Really?
We used to, absolutely, it changed the way we had, the way we wrote software. Instead of having a flat file and beginning at A and ending at Z, searching for things, suddenly we could do like searches. The data became like a giant bouquet of flowers that we could pick from at any point in time. And that became features. Now, I wasn't really involved too much. I was just programming back then. So I don't know if the investor community was all about DB2 and applications using DB2 like they are with AI. But in my world, AI is just another technology component that's going to allow us to build more amazing software. But to be quite honest, we probably wouldn't even think too much about AI if we didn't have things like Kubernetes or, you know, bigger and faster hardware and operating systems. So, you know, it's kind of a chicken and egg question in my mind. But it's all just technology, and it all becomes features. And in 5 years, every piece of software is going to have AI built into it.
I think I am 100% with you, Tracy. I think as I see it on DevOps.com, it's starting to be treated just as another artifact when folks are building software and cloud native, especially too, that, you know, you're just pulling in the AI features, the AI integrations into the larger applications and things that you're building. I don't think it's a whole separate, entity unto itself. It's another piece. So I'm with you.
I'll chime in.
Are you going to be the dissenting voice today?
Well, you did kind of back me into that corner, so I guess I'll take it.
No,
I agree with what you said, but the other side of the coin is, you know, you can look at the investment side. is a category that people invest in, right? And are companies springing up that are AI companies producing AI products. That's one flavor of it, which leans it towards, is it a thing? Is it a category? I think the other thing that's unique about AI is it's kind of like social media. I'm not saying it is social media, but it's like social media that it's not just Facebook. It's the community, the platform that comes with it and all the people involved in it. In AI, it's AI, generative AI in this case, but it's the models that come with it. It's the data. And it isn't just populate your own stuff into a database. Like, for example, your DB2 example, there are different models for different things. And so that leads me to say, I think it's a category. And of course, the thing that will put the line in the sand is when Gartner creates the category for this, that, and everything, it tends to be an industry. But then again, they're not always right either. So that's my opinion. Okay, Alan, you got to arbitrate here.
Well, no, I'm not going to arbitrate. But listening to this, I'm reminded of a story. I remember an old science teacher once told me, which is they're talking about a physicist or an astrophysicist talking about the sun. And he says, you know, the sun is going to run out of fuel and become a red giant and swallow up the Earth in about 5 billion years. And a student raises his hand and says, sir, did you say 5 billion or 5 million? The guy says, I said 5 billion. He says, shh, I thought you said 5 million. Right? So I don't care what's going to happen in 5 million or 5 billion years. I care when we're defining the category, it may be a category in an industry today, and it may not be one 5 years from now or 5 million years from now, right? Look at the Fortune 500 or the Fortune 50 or the Dow Jones 30 from 20 years ago and how many of them are still around or still in that, right? Things change, but I think what focusing on the present, because I live in the present, as I look at it today, AI is its own industry, I think. I think the amount of money, which is one way of measuring it, whether you like that or not, the amount of money pouring into it is crazy, right? We're talking billions and trillions of dollars. And also, I think the impact it's having, not just on us geeky people, you know, the nerds in technology, but the impact it's going to have on civilization demands that at least right now, it's own industry, its own category. Mitch, go ahead.
Professor, did you say billions or trillions?
Well, it depends who you're talking to, but it's both, right? What's his name? Sam from OpenAI wants trillions.
I'm sorry, you set that up. I had to walk into the pitch.
I said some wise ass student out there is going to.
Of course, you know it. Me.
That was Mitchell so in listen, the back I, of the room. Go ahead.
I agree that there is a new category of software that right now is pushing the AI bubble, and that new category allows us to interact with data in a very different way. I can't even tell you. There's not a day that goes by that I don't use ChatGPT. Mm-hmm. But before ChatGPT, there wasn't a day that went by where I wasn't sitting there doing a search on Google.
Yeah.
So ChatGPT just gets a lot of work done for me a lot faster because it pulls it all and hands it to me. So there's going to be new kinds of software developed around AI. There is going to be, the medical industry is going to be revolutionized. I really believe that. I think law, I think accounting. I am waiting for, you know, the government to stop telling me my taxes are due. Just
do it for
me. Pre-file it for me, send it to me and say, do you agree? If you agree, click yes and you're done. Because they have all the data. It's time for them to do that. So I really do believe there's a whole new kind of software that will be built. But I think that every kind of software platform that we think about will be revolutionized by a new way of interacting with data.
Will be AI enabled.
So, mm-hmm. It will be AI enabled, just like it was DB2 enabled. Because mm-hmm. before DB2, we could not do the kinds of we could not write the kind of software we've written now for the last 30 years, I guess it's been. So AI will revolutionize the way we write software and the way we think about data, and it will create a whole new category of software that could not exist before we learned about generative AI.
So I think we're thinking about AI as a category as it pertains to software. What about AI as it pertains to disrupting one vertical after the next? Tracy, you mentioned healthcare, you mentioned attorneys, you mentioned accounting. What about driving, professional drivers and stuff like that? What's it going to mean for autonomous driving? What does it mean? I mean, pick an industry. Just pick an industry, and there's implications of it.
You know, the best analog, Alan, that I can think of mm-hmm. is we don't consider the internet a category today, but it's everywhere. It's in everything.
That's a great analogy, Mitch.
AI, if AI is truly going to be used in everywhere and everything, and yes, there'll be, just like there's internet service providers, yes, there's some AI product companies and technologies, models, et cetera. But maybe it's that kind of a revolution, disruption. It is an internet level thing.
Well, that's what I felt for a while, right? That this is probably the biggest technical innovation since the internet. Mm-hmm. I think what's interesting, though, is that when we look at history, whenever we get this wave, whether it's a DB2, which I would say Oracle was probably longer term, Oracle won the race, right? Because there's a reason why Larry Ellison has the island that he does
Chris
over
Dayton,
there.
DB2 yes. that started.
But, you know, but that just goes to show you is that sometimes those first mover missionaries, they hack with a machete through the jungle, setting a trail for someone to come up and just walk real easy into it, right? But every time we've had these kinds of innovations, it's given birth to the next great companies of the world. I don't care if we go back to Henry Ford. Right, and the assembly line kind of, which you might say was an early version of lean and you know, just in time, whatever. But, you know, every time we see big technical innovations like this or big leaps forwards, there are organizations and people who become the what's the right word I'm looking for? Not the robber barons, that's a bad connotation, but become the giants of that era. And I think that's—
And it is a cultural shift.
Oh, yeah.
It's a big cultural shift. I think that's what AI is going to do more than anything. It's going to change our culture. I mean, it will change it in a way, and I'm hopefully it's going to change it for the better, but I think we're going to see the dark side of AI as well as the, you know, the bright side. And maybe we can learn to make AI super useful for us. You know, I always tell everybody, I think AI should, the Congress should just be turned into a big AI machine so we don't have any emotions in our decision making.
I can see some people getting scared. I see some people really supporting that wholeheartedly and other people having, you know, visions of what is it called? Skynet.
Well, at the same time, you know, there's something to be said about the ability to make data-informed decisions. But the data's got to be accurate. We can always make the data. We can tweak bad data to give our own answer. But there is a cultural shift.
But when AI starts tweaking its own data, that's what we have to watch out for.
And you could write a machine. You mm-hmm. probably could write a workflow that looked at data and actually changed it based on its opinion.
Yeah. It sounds
well,
to me like...
Says- Go ahead, Mitch. General cognitive, you know, AI is 7 months away, according to him anyway.
So, well, right. So was it superhuman or whatever, you know, where it surpasses?
I forget what the term is. But, yep. You know, it's a really good point because it's we don't have anybody that's kind of labeled the AI, you know, the person. You know, there's no Steve Jobs of AI. Just like, you know, you're talking about DB2, I started in sort of the Ingress days. Michael Stonebreaker really popularized the idea around relational database, and then Chris Date with DB2, and then Oracle. And now you don't think of those two, you think of probably Oracle, like you said. I don't know if Altman's the Oracle of of AI necessarily. Maybe, but we don't have that kind of purveyor. You know, so in the
well, it's
80s,
early yet, though, guys. It's only been like a year.
It's early.
Yeah, a year and change.
But we have all those predecessors, like Marvin Minsky. I remember reading his books when I was doing AI work in the 80s, and that Society of Mind, and his whole idea around how AI was going to kind of mimic the way people think and all of that kind of thing. So, you know, I'm sure in the AI world, there are oracles of AI, but in terms of the marketplace, we don't have that person yet. So I wonder who that's going to be.
Could be.
Question.
Good question.
Is Russia, right. Is that what you said?
Let's hope not.
That scares the heck out. And Tracy, you're right. We can't be naive here and think it's going to be all sugar plums and unicorns, right? Mm-hmm. There's going to be a seamy dark side of AI and then a terrifying, horrific dark side of AI too. And it's going to be how humanity manages that and ultimately may decide whether we continue as a race or not, but you know, just how much we use AI. Anyway,
yeah,
Ina, it's a reoccurring theme here on the gang, isn't it?
Comes up often.
Well, it's an important topic. It really is. And understanding the data behind AI, and we talk about the technology around AI, but I think some of the discussion really should shift to the data that's there. You know, I'm big in this area because there's different domains of expertise, and a lot of these domains we don't have a lot of good data. One is the medical industry. If you go to India, they've had electronic health records for quite some time. So their health AI is going to be far more advanced than ours because we don't have these centralized health records. And what does that mean? It means that some of the AI that may come out might be catered to people who live in India, who have different diets, who have different DNA, who have different habits. So the data is important, and when we talk about AI, if we don't talk about the data that's driving it, then we may miss some of the important parts about what the AI's opinion is based on the data, you know, what the cultural influences are. So it's an important topic, and we should continue it.
Absolutely. We're going to take a break on the gang. We're going to come back and talk more about hardware. My God, from AI to hardware. We'll be back in a second. We're back here on Tech Strong Gang. Our next block is around hardware. And you know, there was a time in my life not that long ago where I thought discussions around hardware were over. It was commodity. Whether you know, Google builds their own machines, Intel wasn't what Intel was, AMD, they're all made in Taiwan anyway. But hardware is back in here. We spoke on yesterday's show about ARM having some new architecture they're releasing. And of course, NVIDIA is you know, one of the Fab 7 or whatever we're calling it that's driving the stock market these days. Sharon, we've got some news on our sites around it. What do we got?
We do. So much like you, I can't really remember the last time I had such a visceral wow reaction to an article about hardware that wasn't just like, oh yes, and the hardware is okay, sure, whatever. But yeah, so this week on DevOps, or last week rather, sorry, on devops.com, we had a great article about the need for specialized hardware to drive this wave of AI. And you know what that means for DevOps and software and the future of all these technologies, because without the underlying hardware, none of this is really possible. So how are we developing and improving and accelerating and optimizing the hardware to be able to continue to innovate in this area? And, you know, one of the big things is, as Tracy was also alluding to with DB2, is it's about the data. How do you manage the data? How do you pull the data in? How do you store it? How do you make sure that it's accessible quickly? All of these things. So really, really interesting stuff. And I will let somebody else talk now.
It's okay.
So we have, you know, just like AI is going, is changing the way we interact with data, quantum computing is going to change the way we write software drastically, drastically. If you think about risk, you know, it's great to reduce the instruction set, but if you can speed it up with light and it can have multiple dimensions, and we go into this, I get excited when I talk about it. We go into this non-binary world where it's not ones and zeros, but it's ones and zeros and something in between and something that can be altered to do something else. And you have layers of computing processing with light. Now that is revolutionary. And that is coming. IBM has three centers. If you want to play on it, you can. And if you're a Python developer, it's all open to you.
Is that in 5
it's
million
like
or 5 billion?
Star Trek level, right?
I mean,
trillions of computing sets, you know, yeah. Trillions.
But here's the thing. When do you think we'll see it commercially available?
It's happening.
Commercially available. It's, because my understanding is to have commercially viable quantum computing, we need about 1,000 qubits.
You need a way to cool it, too.
Yes. Well, and the best ones we have now, I think we're up to a couple of hundred qubits. So realistically, I don't think we're going to see quantum computing till the 2030s.
Like, it's kind of like battery technology for cars.
What?
Other things have to advance, right? And you've got to
technology,
get cooling.
Once they solve, they solve a few things, it's going to go.
Because it's the little steps that make the leap forward. It's not... It's usually not one big revolution. It's an evolution. But
yeah, and the fact that IBM has three sites now, they have three sites that you can start writing quantum-based code on it.
I remember the first time I saw a quantum computer, it was at an IBM Think conference in Las Vegas. It looked like a very fancy cappuccino machine.
It's a tube.
But they have come a long way, and you know, and it is, IBM is doing a lot of the kind of groundbreaking research here. Whether they'll be the ones who wind up leading, you know, we'll see how it shows up. But you know, one of the things we're seeing is, look, you can't get a GPU today because NVIDIA's entire production run is already bought and paid for, and we're seeing a, you know, tons of money go into alternative chip designs and companies for the next generation of AI processors. I mean, this is why Sam Altman, with trillion with a T, to your point, JC, why Sam Altman wanted to raise $7 trillion to go build new foundries and next-gen AI chips. Now, I think we could see a little dovetail maybe 10 years out from now where these quantum chips give us the AI power we need or the computing power we need to really take AI, assuming we could generate enough electricity to power all these things and cool them off, right?
Well, I think that's what's really driving it, Alan. I mean, we have Amazon with Trainium, and I think Microsoft's is the Mia chip, and I don't remember what Google's is, but everybody is building one, right? And one, the drivers behind it are the economics of power and performance and electricity that it takes to run all that stuff. We've talked before about sort of the amount of power it takes to run an LLM can be extreme, and that's why you put vector databases, and still it consumes a lot of power. So the need is there, right? If we're going to see this acceleration in the adoption and use of AI, the current model of processing power is not sufficient. And that's why NVIDIA has gone from a niche, very big one in the gaming industry to AI chip manufacturer, and who knows what else next.
And it's interesting how the gaming industry has kind of spurred along the new chip design and the ability to process massive GPUs, right? it has really driven it for us. It's almost like the gaming industry has got us started, got us ready for actually building software on around AI.
Hey, there are a lot of people who will tell you it was the porn industry that made the internet.
It's probably true.
Yeah, no. Right? Fortunately, you're right. I remember being at a conference and they estimated 40 to 50% of every byte transferred on the internet was related to porn. And
that's incredible.
They pioneered e-commerce. They pioneered age verification. They pioneered video over the internet. So from humble beginnings, right? Let he who
had in kitten videos, kitten pictures. Those are the two that fueled.
That was always the joke, though, right? At CES, because they do the other AVN. Big conference at the mm-hmm. same time in Vegas.
Yes, the AVN. Yes. I don't know anything about him, but I AVN. anyway, but let's face it, guys, it's 2024 and we're sitting here talking about chip designs and new hardware. And wow, we haven't spoken about that. That was one of the things about the Intel or Wintel monopoly, if you will, right? Remember, we're all of an age where we remember the Wintel monopoly. Look, it was whatever Intel's next new chip was, right? And it was Pentium for a really long time. And I don't even know what their latest ones are called. It's cool to talk about hardware again, right? And under the... I think it was the infrastructure bill that Congress and the president passed last year. They set aside some outrageous number. Again, I think it was billions, 30 or 100 billion, to revitalize chip manufacturing here in the U.S. And we're actively trying to, I don't want to say steal, but convince chip manufacturers not to build new foundries in Europe or Asia, but to build them here. Even the big guys out of Taiwan, are committed or say they are to building new foundries here in the U.S. So it,
And that has to happen. Can you imagine a one blockade on Taiwan would ruin our entire economy?
Pretty much like what we did to China and cutting off their chips, right?
Right. So we have to. It's a matter of
National security.
National security.
Yeah, critical infrastructure.
But at the same time, it's interesting that this geopolitical situation has converged with the need for faster processing.
Yeah.
So it's a perfect time to do this, to take this project on. But it is, it's a hundred. It's a several billion dollars just to build a plant. It's not a minor investment.
Oh, no, that's right. But if the government is going to subsidize it to the tune of tens of billions of dollars, it could be done. Unfortunately, I'm here. I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
Right.
Let's see, if it doesn't get screwed up and politics doesn't get in the way, we can't even figure out who our allies are and how we're going to control a border. So we can't agree. So, I read an article last week that though the Taiwan manufacturer, who's the big chip manufacturer, the National Semiconductor, I think it is, or something like that. Though they've committed to building a foundry, I think out your way in Arizona, or in that Southwest area, Tracy, originally it was supposed to open in 25, then 27, now they're saying possibly 29, they're moving the goalposts here because of politics and uncertainty. So
yeah, it's an odd time for that industry. It really is a very disruptive kind of mm-hmm. moment in history right now for chip manufacturing because we use them everywhere. Everywhere. Everything has a chip in it.
Well, I learned this interviewing, I think it was BMW or Jaguar at a DevOps Enterprise Summit years ago. Just the steering... Not the steering, the suspension, front suspension on a Jaguar has, I think, 7 million lines of code that needs processors to run. There are dozens, if not hundreds, of CPUs in today's cars.
I think most of us are not informed about how much we depend on chips.
Yeah. Yep.
Everything we do. My stove broke and I didn't want to replace the whole stove. I'm really weird about that stuff. I don't want it to go into landfill. And we found somebody to rebuild the board, and it works fine.
Well, look at the supply chain issues that we had during COVID, right? Chips was a big one for a lot of
manufacturers.
Oh, absolutely. Big one.
And it really pointed out that dependency. In this case, it was on supply chain, but it all, you know, going back to, you know, Taiwan and TSM, I think is the company.
Yes.
Manufacturing there.
But I want to mention something in terms of, you know, we're talking about hardware. When I first started programming, I really geeked out around hardware, because I wanted to understand how a computer worked in order to write code. And in many ways, I believe that a lot of new programmers, they just start coding and they don't understand the hardware that they're coding for.
They don't learn assembly.
They don't understand registers, right? Mm-hmm. They're not looking at things in that deep of a level. And I feel like we need to get back to having those discussions, because we are changing the way that we're building chips. We're changing the way that computers think. And that is going to require us to adjust how we code. So on that, I will not nag at anybody anymore for not learning enough about hardware, but it's an important aspect of computer science.
Absolutely. Hey, we're going to move off of hardware, though. We're going to come back and we're going to be talking about another one of our favorite subjects, cybersecurity. Has there been a breach recently? For sure there has. Stay tuned. You're watching Tech Strong, gang.
SecurityBoulevard.com is the leading resource for news, analysis, and education on challenges facing the cybersecurity industry. SecurityBoulevard.com covers all aspects of cybersecurity, including data security, DevSecOps, cloud security, application security, network security, security threats, and more. SecurityBoulevard.com has the largest selection of security content, featuring breaking news, blog posts, podcasts, and more. Visit www.securityboulevard.com to learn more. SecurityBoulevard.com, home of Security Bloggers Network.
Okay, we're back here at Tech Strong, gang, and hope you're enjoying, you know, Tuesday's show here. We're going to pick up our last segment on our menu, and I'm going to ask Sharon again, Sharon Florentine, to kick it off.
All right. So as you may have heard late last week, ConnectWise they advised their customers of a vulnerability in their remote desktop access tool. So this spawned the usual back and forth on social media and in the tech press about, is this a nothing burger? Is this the biggest thing since Log4j? Is the entire tech ecosystem falling down because of this breach or not? I think, as we've talked about, I think it kind of falls somewhere in the middle, right? I mean, any breach of this magnitude that's going to impact such a huge ecosystem, and, you know, ConnectWise has, I don't even know how many customers, I think that's pretty serious. And the severity rating of this was 8, I think, out of 10.
So I actually think it was a 10.
Oh, was it?
I think it was. I remember coming across and thinking, wow, we don't see 10s that often.
Yeah, it's a 10. Go. It is
You're
a
right.
10.
You just correct.
Looked it up. You're right. Not, yeah.
The East German judge only gave it a 9.8.
Well, to Sharon's point, one of their biggest customers, I believe, are service providers, people mm-hmm. that are running infrastructure. So it isn't just, you know, it isn't just, but it isn't enterprises, businesses running it. Yes, they do that too. But, you know, there are exploits in the wild, which is another reason why it gets taken so seriously. So you could, you know, AT&T network, you could potentially, I'm not saying that's what happened, but you could potentially bring down some pretty big networks or ISPs or hosting providers, clouds, whatever, if this really got out of control.
Well, yeah, we saw this with Kaseya a couple years ago,
yes.
Right? Yep.
Kaseya, and then who? What's the most popular remote desktop access? They bought the GoToMeeting people and all that.
Oh, I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
It was primarily for Windows, whatever it was. But look,
Citrus, or whatever the name is, I can't.
Yeah, that one.
We'll look it up. But we've seen these kinds of breaches before. And look, the scary part of it is it gives a remote user control of your device, which is what most zero days do anyway. But you know what? Last month, we had the mother of all breaches. It was a conglomerate. And the week before that, Bank of America had a, you know, the biggest breach ever. And one of the problems and I'm a security person, so I empathize. But one of the problems I think we have with the breaches and the Verizon data breach report every year is after a while, you become the boy who cried wolf, right? Where, and so what happens is, oh, another breach, yawn, yawn, yawn. Oh, it's billions. Oh, I thought you said it was only millions, right, of records that were breached. Or, you know, it was a 10. It was a 10 plus. It went off the charts.
Yeah. Turn that up to 11.
It's called desensitized. We're desensitized. When you have mega breaches every week, you quickly get desensitized, unless you're a security person. Even security people do too, but security people, you know, of course, use this to, I need more budget. I need more budget. And they have their own motives. And so I don't know what the answer is here. Are you going to eliminate these kinds of vulnerabilities? No.
So rapid response.
Well, this is a discussion we had yesterday.
Yeah, it's like chaos engineering. It's the root cause analysis. You can look at it, but let's look at it after we've solved the problem.
Exactly.
And stop banging on people because something happened. Let's just respond. And then we can think about root cause analysis. Now, the thing about vulnerabilities is we're starting to look at them and react to them, right? There was one for Jenkins. 45,000 Jenkins servers were exposed to a vulnerability that gave you access to the command line from your Jenkins server. So like you said, they're going to happen, and we're starting to get a little dull to it. It's becoming the normal. So what we have to really do is figure out things, rapid response, and how we can apply AI to automatically mitigate if vulnerability comes across, because most of it has to do with bringing in a new version of a package and recompiling or recreating your image and redeploying it, which can be automated.
Yes. Well, I will tell you, one of the biggest advances I've seen over the last, let's say, 5 years is the willingness of organizations to automate patch management. You know, Mitchell and I did a company called Still Secure back in 2001, we started. And our first product was an IPS, intrusion prevention system, when the prevailing state of art was the intrusion detection system. And we thought, what a no-brainer. Who wants to just detect intrusions versus blocking them? And we went out on, Mitchell and I were on the road all the time, you know, evangelizing, selling, convincing. And what we heard time and time again from people was, I can't block automatically. What happens if I stop my CEO from watching his porn or something, you know, or some such thing, or there was an important email that got blocked. And so for the longest time, people were willing to put up with, you know, malicious activity and malicious code and malicious payloads coming in because we'll do it and then we'll block it for the next time. That, to me, was a losing argument. Then we came out with a product called VAM, Vulnerability Assessment and Management. Did a great job of creating finding vulnerability, scanning, and then creating remediation workflows. It was nothing for us to set a switch that would then apply the patch. We had the link to the patch. No one wanted to use it, no one. Then we had a NAC product, Network Access Control. And again, we would check your laptop and make sure you were up to snuff, patches and updates and upgrades and, you know, switches. And we had the ability to go right into the registry and update and, you know, shut things off or turn things on. People didn't want to do that. They said, no, just put them in quarantine. Just put them in quarantine and they'll get to it. So that's been, and Mitch, I don't, if you want to weigh in, that's been a major advancement in our life, in our, you know, in the last couple of years around vulnerabilities, which is the ability to say, hey, that needs to get patched, patch it.
Yeah, I think there's a tipping point of, I don't understand what the problem was, so I don't want to apply a patch to it that might cause downstream problems, right? That was, I think, a lot of the psychology around why those early security products that had automation in them didn't take on. It seems to me, though, that we've kind of crossed that tipping point with another one, which is, but there's so much of it now, right? There's so many vulnerabilities and patches and updates and all that kind of thing. You have to figure out, these things all automate. I don't worry about, by the way, GoTo is the company that now
right. GoTo
is the dominant one. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they bought LogMeIn. I looked it up. But, you know, Zoom comes out with a new update. Everybody apply it. We don't think twice about it. We don't have Zoom Tuesdays where we test the patches from Zoom. It's also the cloud that's gotten us used to this, because it isn't once every 6 months there's an update. It could be 3 times a week. We may not even know about
SaaS,
all the updates.
More than cloud, right? It's SaaS that's gotten SaaS. Yeah. It there.
So the model has changed, right? And I do, by the way, I want to support what Tracy would say. It's absolutely, we've gone from, you know, it's all about protection to it's all about response, right? It's all about rapid response.
We have
response,
to get there. Yeah, more people are doing response. Look, I think there's two things that we spoke about here today that are driving this move to automation. Number one is DevOps. DevOps mm-hmm. is about automating rapid releases, feedback loops. And when you're starting to update your apps multiple times a day instead of once a year, you can't afford to do 90 days of QA before you update, before you patch, right? So I think DevOps and SaaS have driven us to where we are today. What's going to get us over the hill, though, is AI. Because if you have a higher degree of belief that this patch won't break anything else because the AI said it won't, and the AI is pretty smart, you're more than likely to let the AI do it, right? You can build those kind of rules into the AI and say, will this break anything, and look at the code or what have you. And I think that will help us going forward.
It will, as long as we have good DevOps data, lots of transactions,
yep.
Trend history. We need the trend modeling. We desperately need that.
Feedback loops.
So the thing about it, too, and I just want to say, vulnerabilities have always been here.
And they always
have always been here. And we now are aware of them. So yes. We had a security awakening during Log4Shell, or Log4j, and Log4Shell was a component of Log4j. It slapped us all in the face and woke us up.
Again.
So we went from having us from a, well, you know, the if you want to look at the SolarWinds, it was a different kind of problem than Log4j was.
No, but I'm saying go back. There have been Linux kernel vulnerabilities. There've been Intel
it was
processor.
Log4j Log4j hit us the hardest. That was really a hard vulnerability. And that caused an awakening. And now we have an awareness of these vulnerabilities, but we don't have a FEMA response system for them.
No.
We are all trying to figure it out ourselves, and it's just making us all numb, as you said earlier.
Look, you know, I'll throw something out as the old guy. I remember, you remember this too from Still Secure. If you increased your release frequency too much, operations or the customer couldn't take it that often.
Yeah.
Because taking giant, you know, big releases, which if you did them once a year or twice a year, you know, oh boy, that's a big thing. Quarterly? Oh, you know, it was a big thing to digest that much change all at once. And we've kind of flipped the tables, right? To your DevOps point, we can take a lot of small changes because we also know we can react if something happens to one of those,
and
right?
And
to
go I'm
back
minded.
And patch it. So we couldn't go back to a day, those kind of days now. We wouldn't survive that much change, you know, only at one event during a period of time, once a year or whatever it might be.
Agreed. Hey, gang, we're out of time. What a great discussion. Tracy, welcome to your very first Tech Strong Gang broadcast. I hope
Thank you
had fun.
It was fun.
Absolutely.
I knew you'd bring up quantum computing too. I knew that was coming.
It's quantum. Sharon, as always, thank you. Mitchell, thank you very much. Guys, that's going to wrap up Tech Strong Gang, but it doesn't wrap up Tech Strong TV today. We're going to take a short break, and we're going to be back with a lot of Tech Strong TV programming. We got a great show. Check it out. But until next time, which should be Thursday, not tomorrow, the next day, This is Alan Schimmel for Techstrong Gang. We're out.
I'm Bonnie Schneider, sustainability contributor to the Techstrong Group. I'm excited to introduce you to a groundbreaking new initiative from Techstrong Research, the Sustainability Pulse Meter. The Pulse Meter offers valuable insights into how environmental responsibility factors into tech purchasing decisions for key players in the industry. Position your company as a leader in the industry and differentiate from your competitors with the Sustainability Pulse Meter, offered exclusively from Techstrong Research.